trial attorney, one of the best in the country, Philip Bosch. Philip Bosch is well known to many, many in California and throughout the country. He's the founding member and partner of the Bosch Law Group. And Phil is going to be in studio, and he's got a lot to talk about. There are a lot of cases that you do not want to miss. He's been involved with so many high-profile cases, and I think he has a few opinions. And, of course, he has those opinions because he went to college at Brown University. Go Bruins. Now they're the Bears. And he's a fellow Brunonian, ever true. So we're happy to have Phil on the show. We're bringing on Phil Bosch of the Bosch Law Group. He will be here, fellow Brunonian, right after the break. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. We are back right here at Gervie's Law, Talk Radio 790 KABC. I am Alan Gervie, and I'm here with my co-host, Carrie Kasem. And we are so honored to have with us in studio, Philip Bosch. Phil Bosch is with the Bosch Law Group, one of the most highly selective. And I got to say, Phil, your clients are some of the top people, some of the top cases we see in law in California and in the country.
Thanks for that, but we do represent a lot of regular people.
Okay.
That's really...
Yeah, it's so funny because I said the same thing to Gloria Allred, and what did she say? The same answer. You came up with the same answer. I got to tell you, lawyers are really down to earth, and you're going to find Phil is really down to earth. I mean, some of the causes that he's behind is really incredible, and I'll tell you, all our lawyers who we have on the show, they always bring it down to the grassroots, and I think you learn that at Brown University when you go to Brown, like Phil and I did. Before we get to some of those cases that I talked about that your firm handles, we are really privileged to have on the phone with us Ann Bremner. And Ann Bremner was on our show a few weeks ago, and she is not only one of the top trial lawyers in the country, but she is also counsel and spokesperson for Friends of Amanda Knox. Ann, welcome back to Gervie's Law.
Oh, I'm the one that's privileged. Thanks for having me. In the U.S. in Seattle, that's when the plane landed in Seattle to huge crowds.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now,
so supportive.
You know, Phil, I have a question for you. When do you believe, because I know you've had this situation with some of your cases, when do you think that our courts should actually honor judgments of other countries? And doesn't that cause a real conundrum for people here where there's judgments against them in another country?
Well, sure. And Anne, you all did a terrific job. It's even more terrific that it happened by the Italian court rather than having you have to fight through the U.S. courts whether you would honor the judgment of the Italian court. But what happens sometimes in these situations, we had one recently with a Chinese judgment, and then we had another one where the law of Sharia is applied against a United States citizen. And the question of whether a court here is going to honor a judgment of a foreign court is a tough question to answer, and it depends in part on how you view the rights given to the citizen in the proceeding that took place. If, for example, you don't have to have the same system that we have of justice in order to have the foreign judgment apply, and there seem to be a lot of commentators suggesting that even though the Italian system, which seemed frankly bizarre, and Anne, you did a great job navigating it, but basically it seemed like rights that we would expect and find commonplace here really didn't seem to be accorded to her there. And is that necessary in order to enforce a judgment here from a country like that? And the answer really is no. I mean, she could have been sent back, so it was a terrific result that it happened inside Italy, I think.
But why should we, and this is to both Anne and Phil, why should we be respecting another rule of law if we, in this country, don't follow it? And if we talk about Sharia law, I know there was a case back in, I believe, 2010 in New Jersey, which involved a man, a husband and a wife, and sexual relations between the two. And the wife didn't want the man to have sex with her, but he said that he had no intent to hurt her or anything, because under Sharia law, he was having sex with his wife, and it's fine. And the New Jersey law actually respected that. The courts respected the Sharia law, saying, you know, not giving the woman her rights, saying that, well, hey, if that's what he had, no mens rea, there's no criminal intent here. How do we deal with that situation, especially when we look at the gathering of evidence like it was in Italy and say, hey, we don't do things like that?
Well, you know what? The Sharia law example is something very unusual and different. I mean, Sharia is different from our set of laws in the sense that they're not codified anywhere. You can't go to books. Can't even go online and pull up statutes and cases and precedents. The law of Sharia really becomes a series of interpretations by very respected elders in the religion who offer opinions as to how things ought to be, but to research the law and to try to find what precedents and statutes apply, as we do here, requires them to be all written down in an organized and codified way, and that's not what happens in the law of Sharia. So,
and to just say something, I have a lot of Muslim friends, and when I lived in Singapore, there were a lot of Indonesian Muslims that didn't follow Sharia law. Sharia law seems to be kind of made up on the spot. Now, I don't know enough about this, and excuse me if I'm wrong, but it's like, well, you know what? That wouldn't be right. We're going to call that Sharia law. And if a woman gets raped, we need four men to testify, yes, she was raped. You know, it seems like just stuff that randomly, it's arbitrary.
Well, you know, I don't know that I would go so far as to say arbitrary, because a lot of it seems to be based on viewpoints as to moral principles. And part of the reason why some courts might accept that is because when you have a rule of law from a foreign country based on moral principles, it doesn't have to be precisely our moral principles. We want our citizens to be treated well in foreign countries, so we respect foreign judgments as we hope that American judgments, U.S. judgments, will be respected overseas. But, when you come down to looking at the law of Sharia in particular, it's unusual.
Right.
Because you can't find it in precedent.
And we have to differentiate. So we'll be back with both Ann Bremner and Phil Bosch right here on Gervie's Law on Talk Radio 790 KBC. Yes, you are listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC. I am Alan Gervie, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And I am here with my co-host, Carrie Kasem. And we are having a very stimulating discussion right now on the Amanda Knox case. I have Phil Bosch here from the Bosch Law Group. He's right here in studio, and he is talking with Ann Bremner as well, who's in Seattle. And Ann Bremner is counsel and spokesperson for Friends of Amanda Knox.
Is there a civil judgment of some kind for money that survives there in this Italian final opinion?
I didn't hear that last part. I'm sorry.
In the slander suit that was filed against Amanda, I read somewhere that that had been actually upheld as a judgment against her for...
That's true. And that's what I was saying. It's criminal and civil, so that's all upheld, but it's done because on the criminal she served her time.
And
so
what about civil?
Civil? Is there a judgment?
Well, it's done with a judgment.
A judgment against her that is enforceable here, or is...
Let me say this. In Italy, we don't know exactly what they said in their ruling, and for 90 days. At the end of 90 days, they filed what are basically written findings of fact and conclusions of law. It's called a motivation. So we don't know exactly all of the terms that were decided yesterday until we get that written document.
Okay. So there may be still a possibility that Amanda may have to open up her wallet a little bit to pay off this pending civil judgment.
First time she opened up her wallet, I mean, she's had to pay for lawyers for 8 years.
And that's a good question, because Phil brought this up too. How do these people pay for lawyers? How does someone like Amanda Knox pay for a lawyer?
Well, didn't she make $4 million? She did sell a book, correct? Am I right about that? Okay.
Yeah, but she's had millions in attorney fees.
Yeah.
Her mom is a teacher. You know, her dad worked at Macy's. They lived there in a very modest home, the families in West Seattle. And, you know, they just were people's means. So there's been people contributing air miles. We've had fundraisers, you know, and of course she did have the book deal. But, you know, there have been enormous expenses, including travel expenses of all of her family, because they always were there. There was always a family member there month by month by month. you know, the whole time she was in prison for 4 years.
Phil, has that been your experience as well with some of your clients that may not have the wherewithal to pay for their legal counsel?
Amanda is in an obviously unusual and fortunate situation in the sense that she, as a personality, is telegenic. There's a lot of belief that she's innocent and has been railroaded. She's a very sympathetic figure who's been 4 years in prison. I think that the life story rights and the ability to write a book and command lots of money is unique to her in some ways. And people who aren't in that situation do wind up having to go out and seek what sometimes is referred to as alternative billing arrangements with lawyers. You know, our hourly rates are ridiculous sometimes, and you get to alternative ideas, contingent fees, hybrids, pieces of recovery, or whatever it is, barter. Sometimes in the old days, you get chickens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Still, wouldn't that be great, Bill? Alan?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because that's a great way to end our little talk here, because we're being on Gervie's Law. So, Phil, you know, we're going to change gears a little bit because while you have a lot of experience with cases like Amanda Knox, there are other cases that may not be as popular. For instance, let's talk about Anna Nicole Smith. Anna Nicole Smith, to the general public, is not really an Amanda Knox. And I say that because of, and I know you're shaking your head. You can debate me because, you know, I was on the Brown debate team. Actually, my debate partner was Faisal Hussein. Interestingly enough, it was King Hussein's son.
Oh, wow.
The prince,
from Jordan.
From Jordan.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that was way back when. But I see Anna Nicole Smith not as sympathetic as Amanda Knox.
You know, when people say things like that, I have to say that she never certainly had the resources to compete in the public relations arena with the people that she was litigating with, for sure. But there was always a story that I felt was compelling, that when Howard, her husband, an elderly gentleman hitting, you know, 90s, was dying in his last year, there was a DNR, do not resuscitate order, basically, placed on him. And Anna blew into his house one day, and she had the habit of coming in and coming out, and he was very happy always to see her. And he began to choke, and he was choking on his phlegm and dying right there, and he had full-time care. And Anna comes barging into the room. This is the testimony I thought was very compelling from the person there. The person, you know, the nurse there, is knocked out of the way by Anna, who comes in as he's dying and choking. And she wants to know, where is the suction equipment? Where is it?
Yeah.
Well, the DNR order, it wasn't there anymore.
Oh.
So she proceeds for the next 20 minutes to suction him with her mouth. And he survived.
Wow.
And lived for another 6 months and was able to tell everybody who would listen that she was not only the person who saved his life, but the light of his life and the person who he wanted to take care of and loved. And at the end of the day, that really was what the story was about. You're allowed to love who you want to love, however old you are. And
so he didn't have dementia. He was cognizant of everything. So with the do not resuscitate. Now, my dad, when he had the phlegm, he had a do not resuscitate, but they would take the phlegm out of his. They were not going to let him choke to death on his own fluids. That's if he had a heart attack or if he, you know, something happened. What, they were going to let this man right there just choke on his own phlegm?
The nurse attendant who offered the testimony and tells the story under oath, which I just recounted, didn't get to the point of what she would have done if Anna didn't knock her out of the way and take over. I mean, she wasn't doing it at the moment. And the unavailability of the equipment Anna was used to the equipment.
Right.
It wasn't there at the critical moment. Now, you know, you never know what dramatic event would happen if she weren't there. So
right.
I can't say that the nurse was ready to let him die at that very moment. The purpose of the story was that you know, you don't do that unless you have a real serious connection with the person on the on the bed. You call 911 or you listen to the nurse or you do something.
So, Phil,
yes,
it sounds to me like you've just given us your closing argument in the case. And the jury comes back and says, you get $480 million for your client, and they name that one of the largest recoveries at the time for a client.
You know, but that one story wasn't the unusual part of the relationship that they did have. The thing about Howard Marshall, which was so interesting, I mean, the stories about the guy abound. He was the swing block vote and owner of Koch Industries. The Koch brothers have, and his stock remained the piece that between the two Koch brothers, so to speak. And Howard was such an interesting guy that, you know, one day for Christmas he decided to, hadn't bought her anything on Christmas Eve, so a whole truck from Neiman Marcus, a moving van full of material, backed up to his door.
Carrie,
and the,
your jaw can close right now.
It was, and the thing about it, you know, the Neiman Marcus guy who tells, who testified about it, it was the biggest payday for him in his entire career, and he was so happy to come out there on Christmas Eve. But she goes through gown after gown and parades in front of him while he's sitting in the living room. He's the happiest guy in the world that he's buying all these things for. And the guy in the truck, you know, has the crown jewels at the end. It's a $250,000 necklace, and, you know, he wants to put it on her for the – and she says – and he recounts this. She says, how much is that? And he goes, $250,000. And he goes – she says to him, no, that's too expensive. You hold on to that. We're not going to – we're not going to wear that. I mean, you know, he's bought everything else in the whole truck for a private fashion show. So when he comes, when he's done, he asks the guy from Neiman Marcus, he says, Howard, sitting in his chair having fun, he says, okay, is there anything else? And, you know, the guy said, well, there is something, but she told me not to show it to you. And he goes, what is it? And he brings it out. And Howard goes, oh, it's a bauble, and he immediately insists that that gets thrown in with the rest.
That she take it. Wow. And so give us a quick update, because we got a lot of topics to cover. We only have 15 more minutes. So what's the update on the situation with Anna Nicole Smith? Because litigation
continued. It seems like forever litigation.
Yeah.
Some of these things don't have to go on this long, but when large quantities of money are involved, people tend not to get as worried about lawyer fees as they should in most cases. So this has gone on for a long time. And presently it sits in the Texas Court of Appeals, basically. And the reason for that is that one of the parties to the Texas lawsuit that went on, parallel to our federal court litigation here, filed a bankruptcy that froze what was happening in Texas for many, many years. And now we're waiting for an opinion from the Texas Court of Appeals. That's the next thing.
All right. Well, we'll keep our eyes on that. We have to take a quick break, and then we'll be back after this. You're listening to Gervais Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You've heard of Murphy's Law, but have you heard of Gervais Law? Anything that can go wrong can be made right. Now, here are your hosts, Carrie Kasem and Alan Gervais.
Yes, we are back. I am Alan Gervais with the law firm of Rowan, Gervais & Wynn, and we're talking with Phil Bosch here, who is with the Bosch Law Group. And before that, he was with the well-known law firm Kinsella, Bosch, Fujikawa, and Towel. And before that, Gibson, Dun & Crutcher. So he has a long history of working at some of the best firms, and now he is the founding partner and the leader of the Bosch Law Group. We were just talking about Anna Nicole Smith, a case that he's intimately involved with because he represented Anna Nicole Smith and her allies. You also were involved in the Michael Jackson wrongful death case and Gary Coleman. There was a lot of litigation with Gary Coleman through the years, but let's talk quickly about Michael Jackson. You represented Kenny Ortega, and he was a producer for the This Is It concert?
Well, Kenny is not only a producer but a director. He was Michael's close friend. He directed This Is It, which was the show Michael was coming back
right.
with, and all of Michael's tours and major events were directed by Kenny. But he also is a major talent. He's put on Olympic Games. He's put on Academy Awards. The man has a tremendous talent and resume way beyond Michael, even though they were very tight.
So why was he sued, and by whom?
Well, the family of Michael Jackson is a group of individuals. They had their own points of view, and the lawyers named Kenny as one of the defendants early on. Why, I don't know, but probably the theories of who was responsible for Michael Jackson's death started to evolve a bit to who was responsible for hiring Conrad Murray, the doctor, and who supervised him. Who did they drive Michael too hard? That was kind of the
right
theme that was found by the jury not to impose liability.
So we talked earlier in the show about the Lufthansa, of course, the tragedy that occurred with the German wings co-pilot. Why, in the case that you're talking about with Kenny Ortega and AEG, who was the production company, why would they not be potentially responsible for negligent hiring of Dr. Murray or not keeping tabs on what was going on, as we think that Lufthansa will be liable or responsible for the deaths of the 150 people?
Well, there's a completely fundamental difference in both fairness and the way the law looks at the situation when you're a defenseless passenger sitting in an airplane or a defenseless passenger in an automobile versus someone who, as an adult, even though troubled, participated in the events that took his own life. Michael, a lot of the evidence indicates, was troubled in many ways and knowingly following the regimen of Dr. Murray. And so that's a fundamental difference that can't be overlooked. And you never know why a jury decides what it does when it renders a ruling, because you're not part of the jury deliberation. But most of the reports that come out after suggest that this was a situation where people were essentially Michael being held responsible for the conduct that caused his death.
I'm glad you said that, because I felt like there was a lot of responsibility that was placed on everybody else besides Michael. He knew what he was doing. He'd been doing this for a while. But can you tell the story you told us before we got on air, just about what the jury did after?
I am, Kenny Ortega is probably one of my favorite clients of all time, and he was I think wrongly sued, and he's been a terrific host on Dancing with the Stars and other things, or So You Think You Can Dance. And
right.
He's one of the great choreographers as well as directors of all time. And after he went through his credentials, one of the lawyers put him through his paces before he was giving his opinions. And during that time, when he was describing his credentials, here's a man who had produced and directed all of the greats of all time, starting with Elvis and winding up through Michael and the Olympics, and and a very modest man. And when he was through speaking, this I mentioned earlier that what you're alluding to, I'd never seen in my entire career really a jury give somebody, coming off the witness stand, an ovation. Which is what they
I've never
did.
Heard of that
That's
before.
Funny. I mean, and he deserved every bit of it, and nobody said anything.
It was like a performance.
I know.
As his lawyer, I'm sitting there getting goosebumps.
So, yeah.
I'll tell you, I've made a lot of closing arguments in my day, and never has a judge or a jury stood up and clapped for me.
Yeah, I mean,
bravo.
It was a moment, and nobody said anything. The judge didn't say, disregard that.
Right.
Nobody said anything. They just moved on to the next.
Speaking of moving on to the next, we're running out of time. I gotta tell you, Phil got so many things going on. He has a son, Brennan Bosch. I'm going to tell you a quick story. In 2010, I'm a big fantasy baseball player, and I was playing, and a friend of mine, Fred Berkley, who's Elizabeth Berkley from Saved by the Bell's father, came up to me and said, why don't you pick this kid who was on the Detroit Tigers? He came from Harvard Westlake, and of course, since that time, we've seen Max Fried, Lucas Giolito, Austin Wilson, Jack Flaherty, a lot of Harvard Westlake guys go in the top drafts in the Major League Baseball. Brennan Bosch comes onto the Tigers, and he has an incredible three, 4 months, which puts me over the top, and I end up winning Yahoo because no one knew who Brennan Bosch was.
Really? You picked him?
Yeah, and I picked him because of Fred Berkley.
That's
so
great.
You know,
that's
he's great. Now playing for the Cincinnati Reds. He's in training camp now, I imagine.
Did your son play baseball throughout? Was he like, as a kid, young kid, was that his sport?
Actually, he played three sports. He played soccer, he played football, and then eventually he had to concentrate on baseball because he was very good at it. But he always loved baseball.
Right.
And this is now his fourth year in the major leagues, and he got a double with the bases loaded today.
So all right.
Awesome.
It's a good day.
Congratulations.
Awesome.
So you can all cheer on Brennan Bosch. He's working with the Cincinnati Reds now. Now, we're going to turn quickly to Heal the Bay and Tree People. You were the president of Heal the Bay. Is that correct?
I was fortunate to be that for a period of time. And presently, I am on the board and very active with Tree People.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thanking you for letting me give a plug because my thing really here is we... At Tree People, it's a terrific organization, but first off, it comes to the point where everybody, I think, ought to be a tree person.
Yes.
People ought to be connected with the environment. There's nothing greater than the symbol that we have. Tree People not only plants trees, but they're managing essentially the drought in Southern California.
Right.
But also the education they give the kids.
The
when
kids
I was in school, I'd
yeah.
go there and they showed us like the different leaves, the different birds, they really teach you about nature there.
It's a wonderful place. It's a facility up at the top of Mulholland.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just the facility. It's really a state of mind. So we're going to collect about 1 million tree people in the net. Andy Lipkus, who founded it, had a great movement, that plant 1 million trees in L.A., and Tree People did that. And it took a little bit of time, but not that much. And
so where can people go if they want to get more information on Tree People?
Well, there's going to be outreach everywhere. The kids are being, first up. We have kids streaming through there. But basically, there's a outreach in terms of collecting tree people. Tree persons. Everybody's
so is there
a
treepeople.com?
Treepeople.com is a great website, and we have volunteers and donors and people. But it's really exciting to see the growth and all the people
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's so important. Read about trees. You'll see how important it is. It's the Bosch Law Group. Go to Bosch Law Group to read more about Phil and find out what he's been up to. We have Ken Kokin waiting around, but unfortunately we've run out of time.
Ken.
He's going to be on the cutting floor today.
Yeah.
It's too bad. He had a real good question about the health. Earth Hour.
Earth Hour at 8:30 tonight.
We'll celebrate Earth Hour. Shut off your lights for Earth Hour. It's really important. We've done a lot of good work here. Phil, I want to thank you so much for being on Gervie's Law.
Thanks for having me, really.
Such an interesting guy. You got so many things going on. Tree People, Heal the Bay, all Bosch Law Group. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.